This book contains up to four sides per cassette. Side 1, The Ghost from the Grand Banks by Arthur C. Clarke. Copyright 1990 by Arthur C. Clarke. All rights reserved. Narrated by Barry Bernson. This book contains 274 pages on five sides. If you would like to skip over any remaining announcements or introductory material, place your cassette player in fast forward until a beep is heard. Stop at that point to hear the table of contents, or at the second beep to locate the beginning of the book. Annotation. In the year 2012, two groups are racing to capitalize on raising the Titanic. An inventor working with a glass company designs a method of elevating the front half of the ship using glass bubbles. The company's interest is in the rare glass items on board, as well as the potential for attracting tourists. The other group plans to lift the stern by encasing it in ice, and then to reenact the sinking over and over. 1990. From the book jacket. Science fiction legend Arthur C. Clarke has portrayed the near future with a fascination and eerie accuracy unmatched by any other writer. From 2001, A Space Odyssey, and 2010, Odyssey 2, to the spectacular vision of Rendezvous with Rama and Rama 2, he has projected a world immediately recognizable but profoundly, often chillingly, changed. Now, in his first solo novel in years, Clarke combines his prophetic talent with his other great interest in life, the sea, to explore the great crushing depths that contain one particular ship, as legendary as it is real, the Titanic. In the decade before the centennial of the 1912 sinking of the Titanic, two of the world's most powerful corporations, each headed by an eccentric and brilliant man, raced to find a way to raise and then preserve the doomed luxurious ocean liner. The rival CEOs gathered together the 21st century's most brilliant minds, including inventor Roy Emerson, computer geniuses Donald and Edith Craig, and the grand old man of deep water operations, Jason Bradley. For each of these people, the quest to uncover the secrets of the wreck and to reclaim her for all time becomes an obsession, perhaps even a fatal one. By 2012, technology has reshaped some of the details of life on Earth, but it is nature that is sculpting the most violent and terrifying changes. A new sunspot cycle is bringing even more turbulent weather than that of the 1980s, and deep inside the planet, other forces are gathering dramatic alterations that the San Francisco earthquakes of 1989 and 2002 barely foretold. Despite all this, the biggest worldwide story of the century is the tantalizing race to rescue the Titanic from its watery grave. What lies deep beneath the frigid North Atlantic waves is a mystery that has lain undisturbed for a century, the treasure or the terror of a forbidding, still unexplored environment every bit as alien as deep space. With meticulously researched facts and wondrous scientific insight, Arthur C. Clarke has woven an utterly convincing tale of technological possibility and breathtaking suspense in which the totally unexpected awaits. About the author. Arthur C. Clarke is one of the most celebrated science fiction authors of our time, winner of all of the field's highest honors. He was named Grand Master by the Science Fiction Writers of America in 1986. The author of more than 50 books, with more than 50 million copies in print, his most recent bestsellers are Rama 2 with Gentry Lee and Tales from Planet Earth. Along with his distinguished accomplishments in science and science fiction, Mr. Clarke is also a lifelong enthusiast of underwater exploration. He is director of Underwater Safaris Sri Lanka and a patron of the British Sub Aqua Club. He himself began making dives into the oceans of the world in the 1950s. Arthur C. Clarke lives in Sri Lanka. Other books by Arthur C. Clarke. Nonfiction. Ascent to Orbit. Astounding Days. The Challenge of the Sea. The Challenge of the Spaceship. The Coast of Coral. The Exploration of the Moon. The Exploration of Space. Going into Space. Interplanetary Flight. The Making of a Moon. Profiles of the Future. The Promise of Space. The Reefs of Taprobani. Report on Planet 3. The View from Serendip. Voice Across the Sea. Voices from the Sky. The Young Traveler in Space. 1984, Spring. With the Astronauts, First on the Moon. With Mike Wilson, Boy Beneath the Sea, The First Five Fathoms, Indian Ocean Adventure, Indian Ocean Treasure, The Treasure of the Great Reef, with Peter Hyams, The Odyssey File, with The Editors of Life, Man and Space, with Robert Silverberg, Into Space, with Chesley Bonestell, Beyond Jupiter, with Simon Welfare and John Fairley, Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World, Arthur C. Clarke's World of Strange Powers, Arthur C. Clarke's Chronicles of the Strange and Mysterious. Fiction. Across the Sea of Stars, Anthology. Against the Fall of Night. Childhood's End. The City and the Stars. The Deep Range. Dolphin Island. Earthlight. Expedition to Earth. A Fall of Moon Dust. The Fountains of Paradise. From the Oceans, From the Stars, Anthology. Glide Path. Imperial Earth. Islands in the Sky. The Lion of Komari. The Lost Worlds of 2001. A Meeting with Medusa. The 9 Billion Names of God, Anthology. The Other Side of the Sky. Prelude to Mars, Anthology. Prelude to Space. Reach for Tomorrow. The Sands of Mars. The Songs of Distant Earth. The Sentinel, Anthology. Tales from the White Heart. Tales of 10 Worlds. The Wind from the Sun. 2061, Odyssey 3. With Gentry Lee, Cradle. Arthur C. Clarke has edited The Coming of the Space Age, Arthur C. Clarke's July 20th, 2019, Science Fiction Hall of Fame 3, Three for Tomorrow, Time Probe, Arthur C. Clarke's Venus Prime 1 through 6, Paul Preuss, Beyond the Fall of Night, Gregory Benford, Project Solar Sail. Dedication. For my old friend Bill McQuitty, who as a boy witnessed the launch of RMS Titanic and 45 years later sank her for the second time. Table of Contents. Prelude. 1. Summer of 74, Side 1. 2. The Colors of Infinity, Side 1. 3. A Better Mousetrap, Side 1. 4. The Century Syndrome, Side 1. 5. Empire of Glass, Side 1. 6. A Night to Remember, Side 1. 7. Third Leader, Side 1. 8. Private Venture, Side 1. 9. Prophets with Some Honor, Side 1. 10. The Isle of the Dead, Side 1. 11. Ada, Side 1. 12. A Mollusk of Unusual Size, Side 1. 13. Pyramid Power, Side 1. 14. Calling on Oscar, Side 2. 15. Conroy Castle, Side 2. 16. The Kipling Suite, Side 2. 17. Deep Freeze, Side 2. 18. In an Irish Garden, Side 2. 19. Raise the Titanic, Side 2. 20. Into the M Set, Side 2. 21. A House of Good Repute, Side 3. 22. Bureaucrat, Side 3. Preparations. 23. Phone In, Side 3. 24. Ice, Side 3. 25. Jason Jr., Side 3. 26. The Medici Goblet, Side 3. 27. Injunction, Side 3. 28. Mole, Side 3. 29. Sarcophagus, Side 3. 30. Pietà, Side 3. 31. A Matter of Megawatts, Side 3. Operations. 32. Nobody Here But Us Robots, Side 3. 33. Solar Max, Side 3. 34. Storm, Side 4. 35. Artifact, Side 4. 36. The Last Lunch, Side 4. 37. Resurrection, Side 4. Finale. 38. Richter 8, Side 4. 39. Prodigal Son, Side 4. 40. Tour of Inspection, Side 4. 41. Free Ascent, Side 4. 42. The Villa at Sunset, Side 4. 43. Exorcism, Side 4. 44, Epilogue, The Deeps of Time, Side 4. Sources and Acknowledgements, Side 4. Appendix, Side 4. Prelude, 1. Summer of 74. There must be better ways, Jason Bradley kept telling himself, of celebrating one's 21st birthday than attending a mass funeral, but at least he had no emotional involvement. He wondered if Operation Jennifer's director or his CIA sidekicks even knew the names of the 63 Russian sailors they were now consigning to the deep. The whole ceremony seemed utterly unreal, and the presence of the camera crew added yet another dimension of fantasy. Jason felt that he was an extra in a Hollywood movie, and that someone would shout, "Action!" as the shrouded corpses slid into the sea. After all, it was quite possible, even likely, that Howard Hughes himself had been in the plane that had circled overhead a few hours before. If it was not the old man, it must have been some other top brass of the Summa Corporation. No one else knew what was happening in this lonely stretch of the Pacific, 1,000 kilometers northwest of Hawaii. For that matter, not even Glomar Explorer's operations team, carefully insulated from the rest of the ship's crew, knew anything about the mission until they were already at sea. That they were attempting an unprecedented salvage job was obvious, and the smart money favored a lost reconnaissance satellite. No one dreamed that they were going to lift an entire Russian submarine from water 2,000 fathoms deep, with its nuclear warheads, its code books, and its cryptographic equipment, and, of course, its crew. Until this morning, yes, it had been quite a birthday. Jason had never seen death. Perhaps it was morbid curiosity that had prompted him to volunteer when the medics had asked for help to bring the bodies up from the morgue. The planners in Langley had thought of everything. They had provided refrigeration for exactly 100 cadavers. He had been astonished and relieved to find how well preserved most of the corpses were after 6 years on the bed of the Pacific. The sailors who had been trapped in sealed compartments, where no predators could reach them, looked as if they were sleeping. Jason felt that if he had known the Russian for "wake up," he would have had an irresistible urge to shout it. There was certainly someone aboard who knew Russian and spoke it beautifully, for the entire funeral service had been in that language. Only now, at the very end, was English used, as Explorer's chaplain came online with the closing words for burial at sea. There was a long silence after the last "Amen," followed by a brief command to the honor guard. And then, as one by one the lost sailors slid gently over the side, came the music that would haunt Jason Bradley for the rest of his life. It was sad, yet not like any funeral music that he had ever heard. In its slow, relentless beat was all the power and mystery of the sea. Jason was not a very imaginative young man, but he felt that he was listening to the sound of waves marching forever against some rocky shore. It would be many years before he learned how well this music had been chosen. The bodies were heavily weighted, so that they entered the water feet first, with only the briefest of splashes. Then they vanished instantly. They would reach their final resting place intact, before the circling sharks could mutilate them. Jason wondered if the rumor was true, and that in due course the film of this ceremony would be sent to Moscow. It would have been a civilized gesture, but a somewhat ambiguous one, and he doubted that security would approve, however skillfully the editing was done. As the last of the sailors returned to the sea, the haunting music ebbed into silence. The sense of doom that had hung over Explorer for so many days seemed to disperse like a fog bank blown away by the wind. There was a long moment of complete silence, then the single word, "dismiss," came from the PA system, not in the usual brusque manner, but so quietly that it was some time before the files of men standing at attention broke up and began to drift away. And now, thought Jason, I can have a proper birthday party. He never dreamed that one day he would walk this deck again, in another sea, and another century. 2. The Colors of Infinity. Donald Craig hated these visits, but he knew that they would continue as long as they both lived, if not through love, had it ever really been there, at least through compassion and a shared grief. Because it is so hard to see the obvious, it had been months before he realized the true cause of his discomfort. The Torrington Clinic was more like a luxury hotel than a world-famous center for the treatment of psychological disorders. Nobody died here. Trolleys never rolled from wards to operating theaters. There were no white-robed doctors making Pavlovian responses to their beepers, and even the attendants never wore uniforms. But it was still, essentially, a hospital, and a hospital was where the 15-year-old Donald had watched his father gasping for breath as he slowly died from the first of the two great plagues that had ravaged the 20th century. "How is she this morning, Dolores?" he asked the nurse after he had checked in at reception. "Quite cheerful, Mr. Craig. She asked me to take her shopping. She wants to buy a new hat." "Shopping? That's the first time she's even asked to go out." Donald should have been pleased, yet he felt a twinge of resentment. Edith would never speak to him. Indeed, she seemed unaware of his presence, looking through him as if he did not even exist. "What did Dr. Jaffergee say? Is it okay for her to leave the clinic?" "I'm afraid not, but it's a good sign. She's starting to show interest in the world around her again." A new hat, thought Craig. That was a typically feminine reaction, but it was not at all typical of Edith. She had always dressed, well, sensibly rather than fashionably, and had been quite content to order her clothes in the usual fashion by teleshopping. Somehow, he could not imagine her in some exclusive Mayfair shop, surrounded by hat boxes, tissue paper, and fawning assistants. But if she felt that way, so be it. Anything to help her escape from the mathematical labyrinth, which was, quite literally, infinite in extent. And where was she now, in her endless explorations? As usual, she was sitting crouched in a swivel chair, while an image built up on the meter-wide screen that dominated one wall of her room. Craig could see that it was in high-res mode, all 2,000 lines, so even the supercomputer was going flat out to paint a pixel every few seconds. To a casual observer, it would have seemed that the image was frozen in a partly completed state. Only close inspection would have shown that the end of the bottom line was creeping slowly across the screen. "She started this run," whispered Nurse Dolores, "early yesterday morning. Of course, she hasn't been sitting here all the time. She's sleeping well now, even without sedation." The image flickered briefly as one scan line was completed and a new one started creeping from left to right across the screen. More than 90% of the picture was now displayed. The lower portion still being generated would show little more of interest. Despite the dozens, no hundreds, of times that Donald Craig had watched these images being created, they had never lost their fascination. Part of it came from the knowledge that he was looking at something that no human eye had ever seen before, or ever would see again, if its coordinates were not saved in the computer. Any random search for a lost image would be far more futile than seeking one particular grain of sand in all the deserts of the world. And where was Edith now, in her endless exploring? He glanced at the small display screen below the main monitor and checked the magnitude of the enormous numbers that marched across it, digit after implacable digit. They were grouped in fives to make it easier for human eyes to grasp, though there was no way that the human mind could do so. 6, 7, 8 clusters, 40 digits all told. That meant... He did a quick mental calculation, a neglected skill in this day and age, of which he was inordinately proud. The result impressed but did not surprise him. On this scale, the original basic image would be much bigger than the galaxy, and the computer could continue expanding it until it was larger than the cosmos, though at that magnification, computing even a single image might take years. Donald could well understand why Georg Cantor, the discoverer, or was it inventor, of the numbers beyond infinity, had spent his last years in a mental home. Edith had taken the first steps on that same endless road, aided by machinery beyond the dreams of any 19th century mathematician. The computer generating these images was performing trillions of operations a second. In a few hours, it would manipulate more numbers than the entire human race had ever handled since the first Cro-Magnon started counting pebbles on the floor of his cave. Though the unfolding patterns never exactly repeated themselves, they fell into a small number of easily recognized categories. There were multi-pointed stars of 6, 8-fold, and even higher degrees of symmetry, spirals that sometimes resembled the trunks of elephants, and at other times the tentacles of octopods, black amoebae linked by networks of contorted tendrils, faceted compound insect eyes. Because there was absolutely no sense of scale, some of the figures being created on the screen could have been equally well interpreted as bizarre galaxies, or the microfauna in a drop of ditch water. And ever and again, as the computer increased the degree of magnification and dived deeper into the geometric depths it was exploring, the original strange shape, looking like a fuzzy figure eight lying on its side, that contained all this controlled chaos, would reappear. Then the endless cycle would begin again, though with variations so subtle that they eluded the eye. Surely, thought Donald, Edith must realize, in some part of her mind, that she is trapped in an endless loop. What had happened to the wonderful brain that had conceived and designed the 99 phage, which in the early hours of 1 January 2000 had briefly made her one of the most famous women in the world? Edith, he said softly, this is Donald. Is there anything I can do? Nurse Dolores was looking at him with an unfathomable expression. She had never been actually unfriendly, but her greetings always lacked warmth. Sometimes he wondered if she blamed him for Edith's condition. That was a question he had asked himself every day in the months since the tragedy. 3. A better mousetrap. Roy Emerson considered himself, accurately enough, to be reasonably good-natured, but there was one thing that could make him really angry. It had happened on what he swore would be his last TV appearance, when the interviewer on a Late Late Show had asked, with malice aforethought, "Surely the principle of the wave wiper is very straightforward. Why didn't someone invent it earlier?" The host's tone of voice made his real meaning perfectly clear. "Of course, I could have thought of it myself if I hadn't more important things to do." Emerson resisted the temptation of replying, "If you had the chance, I'm sure you'd ask Einstein or Edison or Newton the same sort of question." Instead, he answered mildly enough, "Well, someone had to be the first. I guess I was the lucky one." "What gave you the idea? Did you suddenly jump out of the bathtub shouting, 'Eureka'?" Had it not been for the host's cynical attitude, the question would have been fairly innocuous. Of course, Emerson had heard it 100 times before. He switched to automatic mode and mentally pressed the play button. "What gave me the idea, though I didn't realize it at the time, was a ride in a high-speed Coast Guard patrol boat off Key West back in 03. Though it had led him to fame and fortune, even now Emerson preferred not to recall certain aspects of that trip. It had seemed a good idea at the time, a short pleasure cruise through Hemingway's old stomping grounds at the invitation of a cousin in the Coast Guard. How amazed Ernest would have been at the target of their anti-smuggling activities, blocks of crystal about the size of a matchbox that had made their way from Hong Kong via Cuba. But these TIMs, terabyte interactive micro libraries, had put so many U.S. publishers out of business that Congress had dusted off legislation that dated back to the heydays of Prohibition. Yes, it had sounded very attractive while he was still on terra firma. What Emerson had forgotten, or his cousin had neglected to tell him, was that smugglers preferred to operate in the worst weather they could find, short of a Gulf hurricane. It was a rough trip, and about the only thing I remembered afterwards was the gadget on the bridge that allowed the helmsman to see ahead despite the torrents of rain and spray that were being dumped on us. It was simply a disc of glass spinning at high speed. No water could stay on it for more than a fraction of a second, so it was always perfectly transparent. I thought at the time it was far better than a car's windshield wiper, and then I forgot all about it. "For how long?" "I'm ashamed to say. Oh, maybe a couple of years. Then one day I was driving through a heavy rainstorm in the New Jersey countryside, and my wipers jammed. I had to pull off the road until the storm had passed. I was stuck for maybe half an hour, and at the end of that time, the whole thing was clear in my mind." "That's all it took?" "Plus every cent I could lay my hands on, and 2 years of 15-hour days and 7-day weeks in my garage." Emerson might have added, "and my marriage," but he suspected that his host already knew that. He was famed for his careful research. Spinning the windshield, or even part of it, obviously wasn't practical. Vibrations had to be the answer, but what kind? First, I tried to drive the whole windshield like a loudspeaker cone. That certainly kept the rain off, but then there was the noise problem. So I went ultrasonic. It took kilowatts of power, and all the dogs in the neighborhood went crazy. Worse still, few windshields lasted more than a couple of hours before they turned into powdered glass. So I tried subsonics. They worked better, but gave you a bad headache after a few minutes of driving. Even if you couldn't hear them, you could feel them. I was stuck for months, and almost gave up the whole idea when I realized my mistake. I was trying to vibrate the whole massive sheet of multiplex safety glass, sometimes as much as 10 kilograms of it. All I needed to keep dancing was a thin layer on the outside. Even if it was only a few microns thick, it would keep the rainwater off. So I read all I could about surface waves, transducers, impedance matching. Whoa, can we have that in words of one syllable? Frankly, no. All I can say is that I found a way of confining low-energy vibrations to a very thin surface layer, leaving the main bulk of the windshield unaffected. If you want details, I refer you to the basic patents. Happy to take your word for it, Mr. Emerson. Now, our next guest... Possibly because the interview had taken place in London, where the works of the New England Transcendentalist were not everyday reading, Emerson's host had failed to make the connection with his famous namesake, no relation as far as he knew. No American interviewer, of course, missed the opportunity of complimenting Roy on inventing the apocryphal Better Mousetrap. The automobile industry had indeed beaten a path to his door. Within a few years, almost all the world's millions of metronoming blades had been replaced by the Sonic Wave windshield wiper. Even more important, thousands of accidents had been averted with the improvement of visibility in bad weather driving. It was while testing the latest model of his invention that Roy Emerson made his next breakthrough. And once again, he was very lucky that no one else had thought of it first. His 04 Mercedes Hydro was cruising in benign silence down Park Avenue, living up to its celebrated slogan, "You can drink your exhaust." Midtown seemed to have been hit by a monsoon. Conditions were perfect for testing the Mark V wave wiper. Emerson was sitting beside his chauffeur. He no longer drove himself, of course, quietly dictating notes as he adjusted the electronics. The car seemed to be sliding between the rain-washed walls of a glass canyon. Emerson had driven this way 100 times before, but only now did the blindingly obvious hit him with paralyzing force. Then he recovered his breath and said to the car comm, "Get me Joe Wickram." His lawyer, sunning himself on a yacht off the Great Barrier Reef, was a little surprised by the call. "This is going to cost you, Roy. I was just about to gaff a marlin." Emerson was in no mood for such trivialities. "Tell me, Joe, does the patent cover all applications, not just car windshields?" Joe was hurt at the implied criticism. "Of course. That's why I put in the clause about adaptive circuits, so it could automatically adjust to any shape and size. Thinking of a new line in sunglasses?" "Why not? But I've got something slightly bigger in mind. Remember that the wave wiper doesn't merely keep off water, it shakes off any dirt that's already there. Do you remember when you last saw a car with a really dirty windshield?"
"Not now you mention it."
"Thanks. That's all I wanted to know. Good luck with the fishing." Roy Emerson leaned back in his seat and did some mental calculation. He wondered if all the windshields of all the cars in the city of New York could match the area of glass in the single building he was now driving past. He was about to destroy an entire profession. Armies of window cleaners would soon be looking for other jobs. Until now, Roy Emerson had been merely a millionaire. Soon, he would be rich. And bored. 4. The Century Syndrome. When the clocks struck midnight on Friday, 31 December 1999... there could have been few educated people who did not realize that the 21st century would not begin for another year. For weeks, all the media had been explaining that because the Western calendar started with year one, not year zero, the 20th century still had 12 months to go. It made no difference. The psychological effect of those three zeros was too powerful, the fin de siècle ambience too overwhelming. This was the weekend that counted. 1 January 2001 would be an anticlimax, except to a few movie buffs. There was also a very practical reason why 1 January 2000 was the date that really mattered, and it was a reason that would never have occurred to anyone a mere 40 years earlier. Since the 1960s, more and more of the world's accounting had been taken over by computers, and the process was now essentially complete. Millions of optical and electronic memories held in their stores trillions of transactions, virtually all the business of the planet. And, of course, most of these entries bore a date. As the last decade of the century opened, something like a shockwave passed through the financial world. It was suddenly and belatedly realized that most of those dates lacked a vital component. The human bank clerks and accountants who did what was still called bookkeeping had very seldom bothered to write in the 19 before the two digits they had entered. These were taken for granted. It was a matter of common sense. And common sense, unfortunately, was what computers so conspicuously lacked. Come the first dawn of 00, myriads of electronic morons would say to themselves, 00 is smaller than 99. Therefore, today is earlier than yesterday by exactly 99 years. Recalculate all mortgages, overdrafts, interest-bearing accounts on this basis. The results would be international chaos on a scale never witnessed before. It would eclipse all earlier achievements of artificial stupidity, even Black Monday, 5 June 1995, when a faulty chip in Zurich had set the bank rate at 150% instead of 15%. There were not enough programmers in the world to check all the billions of financial statements that existed and to add the magic 19 prefix wherever necessary. The only solution was to design special software that could perform the task by being injected, like a benign virus, into all the programs involved. During the closing years of the century, most of the world's star-class programmers were engaged in the race to develop a Vaccine 99. It had become a kind of holy grail. Several faulty versions were issued as early as 1997 and wiped out any purchasers who hastened to test them before making adequate backups. The lawyers did very well out of the ensuing suits and countersuits. Edith Craig belonged to the small pantheon of famous women programmers that began with Byron's tragic daughter Ada, Lady Lovelace, continued through Rear Admiral Grace Hopper, and culminated with Dr. Susan Calvin. With the help of only a dozen assistants and one super Cray, she had designed the 250,000 lines of code of the 00 program that would prepare any well-organized financial system to face the 21st century. It could even deal with badly organized ones, inserting the computer equivalent of red flags at danger points where human intervention might still be necessary. It was just as well that 1 January 2000 was a Saturday. Most of the world had a full weekend to recover from its hangover and to prepare for the moment of truth on Monday morning. The following week saw a record number of bankruptcies among firms whose accounts receivable had been turned into instant garbage. Those who had been wise enough to invest in 00 survived, and Edith Craig was rich, famous, and happy. Only the wealth and the fame would last. 5. Empire of Glass. Roy Emerson had never expected to be rich, so he was not adequately prepared for the ordeal. At first, he had naively imagined that he could hire experts to look after his rapidly accumulating wealth, leaving him to do exactly what he pleased with his time. He had soon discovered that this was only partly true. Money could provide freedom, but it also brought responsibility. There were countless decisions that he alone could make, and a depressing number of hours had to be spent with lawyers and accountants. Halfway to his first billion, he found himself chairman of the board. The company had only five directors: his mother, his older brother, his younger sister, Joe Wickram, and himself. "Why not Diana?" he had asked Joe. Emerson's attorney looked at him over the spectacles, which, he fondly believed, gave him an air of distinction in this age of 10-minute corrective eye surgery. "Parents and siblings are forever," he said. "Wives come and go. You should know that. Not, of course, that I'm suggesting..." Joe was right. Diana had indeed gone, like Gladys before her. It had been a fairly amicable, though expensive, departure, and when the last documents had been signed, Emerson disappeared into his workshop for several months. When he emerged, without any new inventions, because he had been too engrossed in discovering how to operate his wonderful new equipment to actually use it, Joe was waiting for him with a new surprise. "It won't take much of your time," he said, "and it's a great honor. Parkinson's are one of the most distinguished firms in England, established over 200 years ago, and it's the first time they've ever taken a director from outside the family, let alone a foreigner." "Ha, I suppose they need more capital." "Of course, but it's to your mutual interest, and they really respect you. You know what you've done to the glass business worldwide." "Will I have to wear a top hat and, what do they call them, spats?" "Only if you want to be presented at court, which they could easily arrange." To his considerable surprise, Roy Emerson had found the experience not only enjoyable, but stimulating. Until he joined the board of Parkinson's and attended its bi-monthly meetings in the city of London, he thought he knew something about glass. He very quickly discovered his mistake. Even ordinary plate glass, which he had taken for granted all his life and which contributed to most of his fortune, had a history which astonished him. Emerson had never asked himself how it was made, assuming that it was squeezed out of the molten raw material between giant rollers. So, indeed, it had been, until the middle of the 20th century, and the resulting rough sheets had required hours of expensive polishing. Then a crazy Englishman had said, "Why not let gravity and surface tension do all the work? Let the glass float
on a river of molten metal. That will automatically give a perfectly smooth surface. After a few years and a few million pounds, his colleagues suddenly stopped laughing. Overnight, float glass made all other methods of manufacturing obsolete. Emerson was much impressed by this piece of technological history, recognizing its parallel with his own breakthrough, and he was honest enough to admit that it had required far more courage and commitment than his own modest invention. It exemplified the difference between genius and talent. He was also fascinated by the ancient art of the glassblower, who had not been wholly replaced by technology and probably never would be. He even paid a visit to Venice, now cowering nervously behind its Dutch-built dikes, and goggled at the intricate marbles in the Glass Museum. Not only was it impossible to imagine how some of them had been manufactured, it was incredible that they had even been moved intact from their place of origin. There seemed no limit to the things that could be done with glass, and new uses were still being discovered after 2,000 years. On one particularly dull board meeting, Emerson had been frankly daydreaming, admiring the nearby dome of St. Paul's from one of the few vantage points that had survived commercial greed and architectural vandalism. Two more items on the agenda, and they'd be at any other business. Then they could all go to the excellent lunch that was waiting in the penthouse suite. The words 400 atmospheres pressure made him look up. Sir Roger Parkinson was reading from a letter which he was holding as if it were some species of hitherto unknown insect. Emerson quickly riffled through the thick folder of his agenda and found his own copy. It was on impressive stationery, but the usual polynomial legal name meant nothing to him. He noted approvingly, however, that the address was in Lincoln's Inn Fields. At the bottom of the sheet, like a modest cough, were the words "Established 1803, in letters barely visible to the naked eye. "They don't give the name of their client," said young, 35 if he was a day, George Parkinson. "Interesting." "Whoever he is," interjected William Parkinson Smith, the family's secretly admired black sheep, much beloved by the gossip channels for his frequent domestic upheavals, "he doesn't seem to know what he wants. Why should he ask for quotes on such a range of sizes, from a millimeter, for heaven's sake, up to a half-meter radius?" "The larger size," said Rupert Parkinson, famous racing yachtsman, "reminds me of those Japanese fishing floats that get washed up all over the Pacific. Make splendid ornaments." "I can think of only one use for the smallest size," said George portentously. "Fusion power." "Nonsense, Uncle," interjected Gloria Windsor Parkinson, 100 meters silver, 2004 Olympics. "Laser zapping was given up years ago, and the microspheres for that were tiny. Even a millimeter would be far too big, unless you wanted a housebroken H-bomb." "Besides, look at the quantities required," said Arnold Parkinson, world authority on pre-Raphaelite art. "Enough to fill the Albert Hall." "Wasn't that the title of a Beatles song?" asked William. There was a thoughtful silence, then a quick scrabbling at keyboards. Gloria, as usual, got there first. "Nice try, Uncle Bill. It's from Sergeant Pepper, A Day in the Life. I had no idea you were fond of classical music." Sir Roger let the free association process go its way unchecked. He could bring the board to an instant full stop by lifting an eyebrow, but he was too wise to do so yet. He knew how often these brainstorming sessions led to vital conclusions, even decisions, that mere logic would never have discovered. And even when they fizzled out, they helped the members of his worldwide family to know each other better. But it was Roy Emerson, token Yank, who was to amaze the massed Parkinsons with his inspired guess. For the last few minutes, an idea had been forming in the back of his mind. Rupert's reference to the Japanese fishing floats had provided the first vague hint, but it would never have come to anything without one of those extraordinary coincidences that no self-respecting novelist would allow in a work of fiction. Emerson was sitting almost facing the portrait of Basil Parkinson, 1874 to 1912. And everyone knew where he had died, though the exact circumstances were still the stuff of legend and at least one libel action. There were some who said that he had tried to disguise himself as a woman so that he could get into one of the last boats to leave. Others had seen him in animated conversation with chief designer Andrews, completely ignoring the icy water rising around his ankles. This version was considered, at least by the family, to be far more probable. The two brilliant engineers would have enjoyed each other's company during the last minutes of their lives. Emerson cleared his throat a little nervously. He might be making a fool of himself. "Sir Roger," he said, "I've just had a crazy idea. You've all seen the publicity and speculations about the centennial, now that it's only 5 years to 2012. A few million bubbles of toughened glass would be just right for the job everyone's talking about. I think our mystery customer is after the Titanic." 6. A Night to Remember. Although most of the human race had seen his handiwork, Donald Craig would never be as famous as his wife. Yet his programming skills had made him equally rich, and their meeting was inevitable, for they had both used supercomputers to solve a problem unique to the last decade of the 20th century. In the mid-90s, the movie and TV studios had suddenly realized that they were facing a crisis that no one had ever anticipated, although it should have been obvious years in advance. Many of the classics of the cinema, the capital assets of the enormous entertainment industry, were becoming worthless because fewer and fewer people could bear to watch them. Millions of viewers would switch off in disgust at a Western, a James Bond thriller, a Neil Simon comedy, a courtroom drama, for a reason which would have been inconceivable only a generation before. They showed people smoking. The AIDS epidemic of the 90s had been partly responsible for this revolution in human behavior. The 20th century's second plague was appalling enough, but it killed only a few percent of those who died equally horribly from the innumerable diseases triggered by tobacco. Donald's father had been among them, and there was poetic justice in the fact that his son had made several fortunes by sanitizing classic movies so that they could be presented to the new public. Though some were so wreathed in smoke that they were beyond redemption, in a surprising number of cases, skillful computer processing could remove offending cylinders from actors' hands or mouths and banish ashtrays from tabletops. The techniques that had seamlessly welded real and imaginary worlds in such landmark movies as Who Framed Roger Rabbit had countless other applications, not all of them legal. However, unlike the video blackmailers, Donald Craig could claim to be performing a useful social function. He had met Edith at a screening of his sanitized Casablanca, and she had at once pointed out how it could have been improved. Although the trade joked that he had married Edith for her algorithms, the match had been a success on both the personal and professional levels. For the first few years, at least. "This will be a very simple job," said Edith Craig when the last credits rolled off the monitor. "There are only 4 scenes in the whole movie that present problems. And what a joy to work in good old black and white." Donald was still silent. The film had shaken him more than he cared to admit, and his cheeks were still moist with tears. "What is it," he asked himself, "that moves me so much? The fact that this really happened, and that the names of all the hundreds of people he had seen die, even if in a studio reenactment, were still on record? No, it had to be something more than that, because he was not the sort of man who cried easily." Edith hadn't noticed. She had called up the first logged sequence on the monitor screen and was looking thoughtfully at the frozen image. "Starting with frame 3751, she said. "Here we go. Man lighting cigar, man on right screen ditto. End on frame 4432. Whole sequence 45 seconds. What's the client's policy on cigars?" "Okay, in case of historical necessity. Remember the Churchill retrospective? No way we could pretend he didn't smoke." Edith gave that short laugh, rather like a bark, that Donald now found more and more annoying. "I've never been able to imagine Winston without a cigar, and I must say he seemed to thrive on them. After all, he lived to 90. "He was lucky. Look at poor Freud. Years of agony before he asked his doctor to kill him. And toward the end, the wound stank so much that even his dog wouldn't go near him." "Then you don't think a group of 1912 millionaires qualifies under historical necessity?" "Not unless it affects the storyline, and it doesn't. So I vote clean it up." "Very well. Algorithm 6 will do it with a few subroutines." Edith's fingers danced briefly over the keyboard as she entered the command. She had learned never to challenge her partner's decisions in these matters. He was still too emotionally involved, though it was now almost 20 years since he had watched his father struggling for one more breath. "Frame 6093, said Edith. "Card sharp, fleecing his wealthy victims. Some on the left have cigars, but I don't think many people would notice." "Agreed," Donald answered somewhat reluctantly. "If we can cut out that cloud of smoke on the right, try one pass with the haze algorithm." It was strange, he thought, how one thing could lead to another, and another, and another, and finally to a goal which seemed to have no possible connection with the starting point. The apparently intractable problem of eliminating smoke and restoring hidden pixels in partially obliterated images had led Edith into the world of chaos theory, of discontinuous functions, and trans-Euclidean metageometries. From that, she had swiftly moved into fractals, which had dominated the mathematics of the 20th century's last decade. Donald had begun to worry about the time she now spent exploring weird and wonderful imaginary landscapes, of no practical value, in his opinion, to anyone. Right, Edith continued. We'll see how subroutine 55 handles it. Now, frame 9873, just after they've hit. This man's playing with the pieces of ice on deck, but note those spectators at the left. Not worth bothering about. Next. Frame 21,397. No way we can save this sequence. Not only cigarettes, but those page boys smoking them can't be more than 16 or 17. Luckily, the scene isn't important. Well, that's easy. We'll just cut it out. Anything else? No, except for the soundtrack at frame 52,763... in the lifeboat. Irate lady exclaims, "That man over there, he's smoking a cigarette. I think it's disgraceful at a time like this." We don't actually see him, though. Donald laughed. Nice touch, especially in the circumstances. Leave it in. Agreed. But you realize what this means? The whole job will only take a couple of days. We've already made the analog digital transfer. Yes, we mustn't make it seem too easy. When does the client want it? For once, not last week. After all, it's still only 2007, 5 years to go before the centennial. That's what puzzles me, said Donald thoughtfully. Why so early? Haven't you been watching the news, Donald? No one's come out into the open yet, but people are making long-range plans and trying to raise money, and they've got to do a lot of that before they can bring up the Titanic. I've never taken those reports seriously. After all, she's badly smashed up and in two pieces. They say that will make it easier. And you can solve any engineering problem if you throw enough cash at it. Donald was silent. He had scarcely heard Edith's words, for one of the scenes he had just watched had suddenly replayed itself in his memory. It was as if he was watching it again on the screen, and now he knew why he had wept in the darkness. "Goodbye, my dear son," the aristocratic young Englishman had said, as the sleeping boy who would never see his father again was passed into the lifeboat. And yet, before he had died in the icy Atlantic waters, that man had known and loved a son, and Donald Craig envied him. Even before they had started to drift apart, Edith had been implacable. She had given him a daughter, but Ada Craig would never have a brother. 7. Third Leader. From the London Times, hard copy and news sat, 2007, April 15th. A night to forget? Some artifacts have the power to drive men mad. Perhaps the most famous examples are Stonehenge, the pyramids, and the hideous statues of Easter Island. Crackpot theories, even quasi-religious cults, have flourished around all three. Now we have another example of this curious obsession with some relic of the past. In 5 years' time, it will be exactly a century since the most famous of all maritime disasters, the sinking of the luxury liner Titanic on her maiden voyage in 1912. The tragedy inspired dozens of books and at least five films, as well as Thomas Hardy's embarrassingly feeble poem, The Convergence of the Twain. For 73 years, the great ship lay on the bed of the Atlantic, a monument to the 1,500 souls who were lost with her. She seemed forever beyond human ken. But in 1985, thanks to revolutionary advances in submarine technology, she was discovered, and hundreds of her pitiful relics brought back to the light of day. Even at the time, many considered this a kind of desecration. Now, according to rumor, much more ambitious plans are afoot. Various consortia, as yet unidentified, have been formed to raise the ship, despite her badly damaged condition. Frankly, such a project seems completely absurd, and we trust that none of our readers will be induced to invest in it. Even if all the engineering problems can be overcome, just what would the salvors do with 40 or 50,000 tons of scrap iron? Marine archaeologists have known for years that metal objects, except, of course, gold, disintegrate rapidly when brought into contact with air after long submergence. Protecting the Titanic might be even more expensive than salvaging her. It is not as if, like the Vasa or the Mary Rose, she is a time capsule giving us a glimpse of a lost era. The 20th century is adequately, sometimes all too adequately, documented. We can learn nothing that we do not already know from the debris 4 kilometers down off the Grand Banks of Newfoundland. There is no need to revisit her to be reminded of the most important lesson the Titanic can teach, the dangers of overconfidence, of technological hubris. Chernobyl, Challenger, Lagrange 3, and experimental Fuser 1 have shown us where that can lead. Of course, we should not forget the Titanic, but we should let her rest in peace. 8. Private Venture. Roy Emerson was bored, as usual, though this was a fact that he hated to admit, even to himself. There were times when he would wander through his superbly equipped workshop, with its gleaming machine tools and tangles of electronic gear, quite unable to decide which of his expensive toys he wished to play with next. Sometimes he would start on a project suggested by one of the countless network magazines and join a group of similarly inclined hobbyists scattered all over the world. He seldom knew their names, only their often facetious call signs, and he was careful not to give his. Since he had been listed as one of the 100 richest men in the United States, he had learned the value of anonymity. After a few weeks, however, the latest project would lose its novelty, and he would pull the plug on his unseen playmates, changing his ident code so that they could no longer contact him. For a few days, he would drink too much and waste time exploring the personal notice boards whose contents would have appalled the first pioneers of electronic communication. Occasionally, after the long-suffering Joe Wickram had checked it out, he would answer some advertisement for personal services that intrigued him. The results were seldom very satisfying and did nothing to improve his self-respect. The news that Diana had just remarried hardly surprised him, but left him depressed for several days, even though he tried to embarrass her by a vulgarly expensive wedding present. All play and no work was making Emerson a very dull Roy. Then, overnight, a call from Rupert Parkinson aboard his racing trimaran in the South Pacific abruptly changed his life. "What's your phone cipher?" was Rupert's unexpected opening remark. "Why, normally I don't bother, but I can switch to NSA, too, if it's really important. Only problem, it tends to chop speech on long-distance circuits, so don't talk too fast and don't overdo that Oxford accent. Cambridge, please, and Harvard. Here we go." There was a 5-second pause filled with strange beepings and twitterings. Then Rupert Parkinson, still recognizable though subtly distorted, was back on the line. "Can you hear me?" "Fine. Now, you remember that last board meeting and the item about the glass microspheres?" "Of course," Emerson answered a little nervously. He wondered again if he had made a fool of himself. "You were going to look into it. Was my guess correct?" "Bang on, old man," to coin an expression. "Our lawyers had some expensive lunches with their lawyers, and we did a few sums together. They never told us who the client was, but we found out easily enough. A British video network, doesn't matter which, thought it would make a splendid series, in real time, culminating with the actual racing. But they lost interest when they found what it would cost, and the deal's off." "Pity. What would it cost?" "Just to manufacture enough spheres to lift 50 kilotons, at least $20 million. But that would be merely the beginning. You've got to get them down there, properly distributed. You can't just squirt them into the hull. Even if they'd stay put, they'd soon tear the ship apart. And I'm only talking about the forward section, of course. The smashed-up stern's another problem. Then you've got to get it unstuck from the seabed. It's half buried in mud. That will mean a lot of work by submersibles, and there aren't many that can operate 4 clicks down. I don't think you could do the job for less than $100 million. It might even be several times as much." "So, the deal's off. Then why are you calling me?" "Never thought you'd ask. I've been doing a little private venturing of my own. After all, we Parkinsons have a vested interest. Great-granddad's down there, or at least his baggage, in Suite 3, starboard." "$100 megabucks worth?" "Quite possibly. But that's unimportant. Some things are beyond price. Have you ever heard of Andrea Bellini?"
"Sounds like a baseball player."
"He was the greatest craftsman in glass that Venice ever produced. To this day, we don't know how he made some of his... Anyway, back in the 1870s, we managed to buy the cream of the Glass Museum's collection. In its way, it was as big a prize as the Elgin Marbles. For years, the Smithsonian had been begging us to arrange a loan, but we always refused. Too risky to send such a priceless cargo across the Atlantic. Until, of course, someone built an unsinkable ship. Then we had no excuse."
"Fascinating. And now you've mentioned him, I remember seeing some of Bellini's work the last time I was in Venice. But wouldn't it all be smashed to pieces?
Almost certainly not. It was expertly packed, as you can imagine. And anyway, masses of the ship's crockery survived, even though it was completely unprotected. Remember that White Star dining set they auctioned at Sotheby's a couple of years ago?
Okay, I'll grant you that. But it seems a little extravagant to raise the whole ship just for a few crates.
Of course it is. But it's one major reason why we Parkinsons should get involved.
And the others?
You've been on the board long enough to know that a little publicity doesn't do any harm. The whole world would know whose product did the lifting.
Still not good enough, Emerson said to himself. Parkinson's was doing very nicely, and by no means all of the publicity would be favorable. To many people, the wreck was almost sacred. They branded those who tampered with it as grave robbers. But he knew that men often concealed, even failed to recognize, their true motives. Since he had joined the board, he had grown to know and like Rupert, though he would hardly call him a close friend. It was not easy for an outsider to get close to the Parkinsons. Rupert had his own account to settle with the sea. 5 years ago, it had taken his beautiful 25-meter yacht Aurora, when she had been dismasted by a freak squall off the Scillies and smashed to pieces on the cruel rocks that had claimed so many victims through the centuries. By pure chance, he had not been aboard. It had been a routine trip, a bus run, from Cowes to Bristol for a refit. All the crew had been lost, including the skipper. Rupert Parkinson had never quite recovered. At the same time, he had lost both his ship and, as was well known, his lover. The playboy image he now wore in self-defense was only skin deep.
All very interesting, Rupert, but exactly what do you have in mind? Surely you don't expect me to get involved.
Yes and no. At the moment, it's a, what do they call it, thought experiment. I'd like to get a feasibility study done, and I'm prepared to finance that myself. Then, if the project makes any sense at all, I'll present it to the board.
But $100 million? There's no way the company would risk that much. The shareholders would have us behind bars in no time, whether in a jail or a lunatic asylum, I'm not sure.
It might cost more, but I'm not expecting Parkinson's to put up all the capital. Maybe 20 or 30 M. I have some friends who'll be able to match that.
Still not enough.
Exactly.
There was a long silence, broken only by faintly querulous bleeps from the real-time decoding system as it searched in vain for something to unscramble.
Very well, said Emerson at last. I'll go 50-50 with you, on the feasibility report at any rate. Who's your expert? Will I know him?
I think so, Jason Bradley.
Oh, the giant octopus man.
That was just a sideshow, but look what it did to his public image.
And his fee, I'm sure. Have you sounded him out? Is he interested?
Very, but then so is every ocean engineering firm in the business. I'm sure some of them will be prepared to put up their own money, or at least work on a no-profit basis, just for the PR.
Okay, go ahead. But frankly, I think it's a waste of money. We'll just end up with some very expensive reading matter when Mr. Bradley delivers his report. Anyway, I don't see what you'll do with 50,000 tons, or whatever it is, of rusty scrap iron.
Leave that to me. I've a few more ideas, but I don't want to talk about them yet. If some of them work out, the project would pay for itself, eventually. You might even make a profit.
Emerson doubted if that "you" was a slip of the tongue. Rupert was a very smooth operator and knew exactly what he was doing. And he certainly knew that his listener could easily underwrite the whole operation, if he wished.
Just one other thing, Parkinson continued. Until I give the okay, which won't be until I get Bradley's report, not a word to anyone, especially Sir Roger. He'll think we're crazy.
You mean to say, Emerson retorted, that there could be the slightest possible doubt?
9. Profits with some honor. To the editor, the London Times. From Lord Aldous of Brightfount, O.M., President Emeritus, Science Fiction World Association. Dear Sir, your third leader, 7 April 15, concerning plans to raise the Titanic again, demonstrates what an impact this disaster, by no means the worst in maritime history, has had upon the imagination of mankind. One extraordinary aspect of the tragedy is that it had been described with uncanny precision 14 years in advance. According to Walter Lord's classic account of the disaster, A Night to Remember, in 1898, a struggling author named Morgan Robertson concocted a novel about a fabulous Atlantic liner far larger than any that had ever been built. Robertson loaded it with rich and complacent people
and then wrecked it one cold April night on an iceberg. The fictional liner had almost exactly the Titanic's size, speed, and displacement. It also carried 3,000 people and lifeboats for only a fraction of them. Coincidence, of course, but there is one little detail that chills my blood. Robertson called his ship the Titan. I would also like to draw attention to the fact that two members of the profession I am honored to represent, that of writers of science fiction, went down with the Titanic. One, Jacques Futrelle, is now almost forgotten, and even his nationality is uncertain. But he had attained sufficient success at the age of 37 with The Diamond Master and The Thinking Machine to travel first class with his wife, who, like 97% of first class ladies and only 55% of third class ones, survived the sinking. Far more famous was a man who wrote only one book, A Journey in Other Worlds, A Romance of the Future, which was published in 1894. This somewhat mystical tour around the solar system in the year 2000 described anti-gravity and other marvels. Arkham House reprinted the book on its centennial. I described the author as famous, but that is a gross understatement. His name is the only one that appears above the huge headline of the New York American for 16 April 1912, 1,500 to 1,800 dead. He was the multimillionaire John Jacob Astor, sometimes labeled as the richest man in the world. He was certainly the richest writer of science fiction who ever lived, a fact which may well mortify admirers of the late L. Ron Hubbard, should any still exist. I have the honor to be, sir, yours sincerely, Aldous of Brightfount, O.M., President Emeritus, S.F.W.A. 10. The Isle of the Dead. Every trade has its acknowledged leaders whose fame seldom extends beyond the boundaries of their profession. At any given time, few could name the world's top accountant, dentist, sanitary engineer, insurance broker, mortician, to mention only a handful of unglamorous but essential occupations. There are some ways of making a living, however, which have such high visibility that their practitioners become household names. First, of course, are the performing arts, in which anyone who becomes a star may be instantly recognizable to a large fraction of the human race. Sports and politics are close behind, and so, a cynic might argue, is crime. Jason Bradley fit into none of these categories and had never expected to be famous. The Glomar Explorer episode was more than 3 decades in the past, and even if it had not been shrouded in secrecy, his role had been far too obscure to be noteworthy. Although he had been approached several times by writers hoping to get a new angle on Operation Jennifer, nothing had ever come of their efforts. It seemed likely that even at this date, the CIA felt that the single book on the subject was one too many and had taken steps to discourage other authors. For several years after 1974, Bradley had been visited by anonymous but polite gentlemen who had reminded him of the documents he signed when he was discharged. They always came in pairs, and sometimes they offered him employment of an unspecified nature. Though they assured him that it would be interesting and well paid, he was then earning very good money on North Sea oil rigs and was not tempted. It was now more than a decade since the last visitation, but he did not doubt that the company still had him carefully stockpiled in its vast data banks at Langley, or wherever they were these days. He was in his office on the 46th floor of the Teague Tower, now dwarfed by Houston's later skyscrapers, when he received the assignment that was to make him famous. The date happened to be April 2nd, and at first Bradley thought that his occasional client, Jeff Rawlings, had got it a day late. Despite his awesome responsibilities as operations manager on the Hibernia platform, Jeff was noted for his sense of humor. This time he wasn't joking, yet it was quite a while before Jason could take his problem seriously. "Do you expect me to believe," he said, "that your million-ton rig has been shut down by an octopus?" "Not the whole operation, of course, but Manifold One, our best producer, 40,000 barrels a day, 5 flow lines running into it, all going full blast, until yesterday." The Hibernia project, it suddenly occurred to Jason, had the same general design as an octopus. Tentacles, or pipelines, ran out along the seabed from the central body to the dozen wells that had been drilled 3,000 meters through the oil-rich sandstone. Before they reached the main platform, the flow lines from several individual wells were combined at a production manifold, also on the seabed, nearly 100 meters down. Each manifold was an automated industrial complex the size of a large apartment building, containing all the specialized equipment needed to handle the high-pressure mixture of gas, oil, and water erupting from the reservoirs far below. Tens of millions of years ago, nature had created and stored this hidden treasure. It was no simple matter to wrest it from her grasp. Tell me exactly what happened. This circuit secure? Of course. 3 days ago, we started getting erratic instrument readings. The flow was perfectly normal, so we weren't too worried. But then there was a sudden data cutoff. We lost all monitoring facilities. It was obvious that the main fiber optic trunk had been broken, and of course the automatics shut everything down. No surge problems? No. Slug catcher worked perfectly, for once. And then? SOP. We sent down a camera, Eyeball Mark V. Guess what? The batteries died. Nope. The umbilical got snagged in the external scaffolding before we could even go inside to look around. What happened to the driver? Well, the kitchen isn't completely mechanized, and Chef Dubois can always use some unskilled labor. So, you lost the camera. What happened next? We haven't lost it. We know exactly where it is. But all it shows are lots of fish. So we sent down a diver to untangle things and to see what he could find. Why not an ROV, Rove? There were always several underwater robots, remotely operated vehicles, on any offshore oil field. The old days when human divers did all the work were long since past. There was an embarrassed silence at the other end of the line. Afraid you'd ask me that? We've had a couple of accidents. Two Roves are being rebuilt, and the rest can't be spared from an emergency job on the Avalon platform. Not your lucky day, is it? So that's why you've called the Bradley Corporation. No job too deep. Tell me more. Spare me that beat-up slogan. Since the depth's only 90 meters, we sent down a diver in standard Heliox gear. Well, ever heard a man screaming in helium? Not a very nice noise. When we got him up and he was able to talk again, he said the entire rig was covered by an octopus. He swore it was 100 meters across. That's ridiculous, of course, but there's no doubt it's a monster. However big it is, a small charge of dynamite should encourage it to move. Much too risky. You know the layout down there. After all, you helped install it. If the camera's still working, doesn't it show the beast? We did get a glimpse of a tentacle, but no way of judging its size. We think it's gone back inside. We're worried that it might rip out more cables. You don't suppose it's fallen in love with the plumbing? Very funny. My guess is that it's found a free lunch. You know, the bloody oasis effect that publicity's always boasting about. Bradley did, indeed. Far from being damaging to the environment, virtually all underwater artifacts were irresistibly attractive to marine life and often became a target for fishing boats and a paradise for anglers. He sometimes wondered how fish had managed to survive before mankind generously provided them with condominiums by scattering wrecks across the seabeds of the world. Perhaps a cattle prod would do the trick, or a heavy dose of subsonics. We don't care how it's done, as long as there's no damage to the equipment. Anyway, it looked like a job for you. And Jim, of course. Is he ready? He's always ready. How soon can you get to St. John's? There's a Chevron jet at Dallas. It can pick you up in an hour. What does Jim weigh? 1.5 tons. No problem. When can you be at the airport? Give me 3 hours. This isn't my normal line of business. I'll have to do some research. Usual terms? Yes, $100K plus expenses. And no cure, no pay? Bradley smiled. The centuries-old salvage formula had probably never been invoked in a case like this, but it seemed applicable. And it would be an easy job. 100 meters, indeed. What nonsense. Of course. Call you back in 1 hour to confirm. Meanwhile, please fax the manifold plans so I can refresh my memory. Right. And I'll see what else I can find out while I'm waiting for your call. There was no need to waste time packing. Bradley always had two bags ready, one for the tropics, one for the Arctic. The first was very little used. Most of his jobs, it seemed, were in unpleasant parts of the world, and this one would be no exception. The North Atlantic at this time of year would be cold and probably rough. Not that it would matter much 100 meters down. Those who thought of Jason Bradley as a tough, no-nonsense roughneck would have been surprised at his next action. He pressed a button on his desk console, lay back in his partially reclining chair, and closed his eyes. To all outward appearances, he was asleep. It had been years before he discovered the identity of the haunting music that had ebbed and flowed across Glomar Explorer's deck almost half a lifetime ago. Even then, he had known it must have been inspired by the sea. The slow rhythm of the waves was unmistakable. And how appropriate that the composer was Russian, the most underrated of his country's three titans, seldom mentioned in the same breath as Tchaikovsky and Stravinsky. As Sergei Rachmaninoff himself had done long ago, Jason Bradley had stood transfixed before Arnold Bricklin's Isle of the Dead, and now he was seeing it again in his mind's eye. Sometimes he identified himself with the mysterious, shrouded figure standing in the boat. Sometimes he was the oarsman, Karen, and sometimes he was the sinister cargo, being carried to its last resting place beneath the cypresses. It was a secret ritual that had somehow evolved over the years, and which he believed had saved his life more than once. For while he was engrossed in the music, his subconscious mind, which apparently had no interest in such trivialities, was very busy indeed, analyzing the job that lay ahead and foreseeing problems that might arise. At least, that was Bradley's more than half-seriously held theory, which he never intended to disprove by too close an examination. Presently, he sat up, switched off the music module, and swung his seat around to one of his half-dozen keyboards. The NEXT Mark IV, which stored most of his files and information, was hardly the last word in computers, but Bradley's business had grown up with it, and he had resisted all updates on the sound principle, if it works, don't fix it. "I thought so," he muttered as he scanned the encyclopedia entry, Octopus. "Maximum size when fully extended may be as much as 10 meters, weight 50 to 100 kilograms. Bradley had never seen an octopus even approaching this size, and like most divers he knew, considered them charming and inoffensive creatures. That they could be aggressive, much less dangerous, was an idea he had never taken seriously. See also entry on sports underwater. He blinked twice at this last reference, instantly accessed it, and read it with a mixture of amusement and surprise. Although he had often tried his hand at sports diving, he had the typical professional's disdain for amateur scuba nauts. Too many of them had approached him looking for jobs, blissfully unaware of the fact that most of his work was in water too deep for unprotected humans, often with zero light and even zero visibility. But he had to admire the intrepid divers of Puget Sound, who wrestled with opponents heavier than themselves and with four times as many arms, and brought them back to the surface without injuring them. That, it seemed, was one of the rules of the game. If you hurt your octopus before you put it back in the sea, you were disqualified. The encyclopedia's brief video sequence was the stuff of nightmares. Bradley wondered how well the Puget Sounders slept, but it gave him one vital piece of information. How did these crazy sportsmen, and sportswomen, there were plenty of them as well, persuade a peaceable mollusk to emerge from its lair and indulge in hand-to-tentacle combat? He could hardly believe that the answer was so simple. Pausing only to place a couple of unusual orders with his regular supplier, he grabbed his travel kit and headed for the airport. "Easiest 100K I ever earned," Jason Bradley told himself. 11. Ada. A child with two brilliant parents has a double handicap, and the Craigs had made life even more difficult for their daughter by naming her Ada. This well-advertised tribute to the world's first computer theorist perfectly summed up their ambitions for the child's future. It would, they devoutly hoped, be happier than that of Lord Byron's tragic daughter, Ada, Lady Lovelace. It was a great disappointment, therefore, when Ada showed no particular talent for mathematics. By the age of 6, the Craigs' friends had joked, she should at least have discovered the binomial theorem. As it was, she used her computer without showing any real interest in its operation. It was just another of the household gadgets, like vidphones, remote controllers, voice-operated systems, wall TV, color fax. Ada even seemed to have difficulty with simple logic, finding AND, NOR, and NAND gates quite baffling. She took an instant dislike to Boolean operators and had been known to burst into tears at the sight of an if-then statement. "Give her time," Donald pleaded to the often impatient Edith. "There's nothing wrong with her intelligence. I was at least 10 before I understood recursive loops. Maybe she's going to be an artist. Her last report gave her straight A's in painting, clay modeling, and a D in arithmetic. What's worse, she doesn't seem to care. That's what I find so disturbing." Donald did not agree, but he knew that it would only start another fight if he said so. He loved Ada too much to see any faults in her. As long as she was happy and did reasonably well at school, that was all that mattered to him now. Sometimes he wished that they had not saddled her with that evocative name, but Edith still seemed determined to have a genius-type daughter. That was now the least of their disagreements. Indeed, if it had not been for Ada, they would have separated long ago. "What are we going to do about the puppy?" he asked, eager to change the subject. "It's only 3 weeks to her birthday, and we promised." "Well," said Edith, softening for a moment, "she still hasn't made up her mind. I only hope she doesn't choose something enormous, like a Great Dane. Anyway, it wasn't a promise. We told her it would depend on her next school test." "You told her," Donald thought. "Whatever the result, Ada's going to get that puppy. Even if she wants an Irish wolfhound, which, after all, would be the appropriate dog for this huge estate." Donald was still not sure if it was a good idea, but they could easily afford it, and he had long since given up arguing with Edith once she had made up her mind. She had been born and reared in Ireland, and she was determined that Ada should have the same advantage. Conroy Castle had been neglected for over half a century, and some portions were now almost in ruins. But what was left was more than ample for a modern family, and the stables were in particularly good shape, having been maintained by a local riding school. After vigorous scrubbing and extensive chemical warfare, they provided excellent accommodation for computers and communications equipment. The local residents thought it was a very poor exchange. On the whole, however, the locals were friendly enough. After all, Edith was an Irish girl who had made good, even if she had married an Englishman. And they heartily approved of the Craigs' efforts to restore the famous gardens to at least some vestige of their 19th-century glory. One of Donald's first moves, after they had made the West Wing ground floor livable, was to repair the Camera Obscura, whose dome was a late Victorian afterthought, some said excrescence, on the castle battlements. It had been installed by Lord Francis Conroy, a keen amateur astronomer and telescope maker, during the last decade of his life. When he was paralyzed, but too proud to be pushed around the estate in a wheelchair, he had spent hours surveying his empire from this vantage point and issuing instructions to his army of gardeners by semaphore. The century-old optics were still in surprisingly good condition and threw a brilliant image of the outside world onto the horizontal viewing table. Ada was fascinated by the instrument and the sense of power it gave her as she scanned the castle grounds. It was, she declared, much better than TV or the boring old movies her parents were always screening. And up here on the battlements, she could not hear the sound of their angry voices. 12. A mollusk of unusual size. The first bad news came soon after Bradley had settled down to his belated lunch. Chevron Canada fed its VIPs well, and Jason knew that as soon as he hit St. John's, he'd have little time for leisurely regular meals. "Sorry to bother you, Mr. Bradley," said the steward, "but there's an urgent call from head office." "Can't I take it from here?" "I'm afraid not. There's video as well. You'll have to go back." "Damn," said Bradley, taking one quick mouthful of a splendid piece of Texas steak. He reluctantly pushed his plate aside and walked to the communications booth at the rear of the jet. The video was only one way, so he had no compunction about continuing to chew as Rawlings gave his report. "We've been doing some research, Jason, about octopus sizes. The people out on the platform weren't very happy when you laughed at their estimate." "Too bad. I've checked with my encyclopedia. The very largest octopus is under 10 meters across." "Then you'd better look at this." Though the image that flashed on the screen was obviously a very old photograph, it was of excellent quality. It showed a group of men on a beach surrounding a shapeless mass about the size of an elephant. Several other photos followed in quick succession. They were all equally clear, but of what it was impossible to say. "If I had to put any money on it," said Bradley, "my guess would be a badly decomposed whale. I've seen and smelled several. They looked just like that. Unless you're a marine biologist, you could never identify it. That's how sea serpents get born." "Nice try, Jason. That's exactly what most of the experts said at the time, which, by the way, was 1896. And the place was Florida, St. Augustine Beach, to be precise. My steak is getting cold, and this isn't exactly helping my appetite. I won't take much longer. That little morsel weighed about 5 tons. Luckily, a piece was preserved in the Smithsonian, so that 50 years later scientists were able to re-examine it. There's no doubt that it was an octopus, and it must have had a span of almost 70 meters. So So our diver's guess of 100 may not have been all that far out.
Bradley was silent for a few moments, processing this very unexpected and unwelcome piece of information.
"I'll believe it when I see it," he said, "though I'm not sure that I want to."
"By the way," said Rawlings, "you haven't mentioned this to anyone?"
"Of course not," snapped Jason, annoyed at the very suggestion.
"Well, the media have got hold of it somehow. The Newsfax headlines are already calling it Oscar."
"Good publicity. What are you worried about?"
"We'd hoped you could get rid of the beast without everyone looking over your shoulder. Now we've got to be careful. Mustn't hurt dear little Oscar. The World Wildlife people are watching, not to mention Blue Peas."
"Those crazies?"
"Maybe, but WW has to be taken seriously. Remember who they have as president. We don't want to upset the palace."
"I'll do my best to be gentle. Definitely no nukes, not even a small one."
The first bite of his now tepid steak triggered a wry memory. Several times, Bradley recalled, he had eaten octopus and quite enjoyed it. He hoped he could avoid the reverse scenario.
13. Pyramid Power.
When the sobbing Ada had been sent to her room, Edith and Donald Craig stared at each other in mutual disbelief.
"I don't understand it," said Edith at last. "She's never been disobedient before. In fact, she always got on very well with Miss Ives."
"And this is just the sort of test she's usually very good at. No equations, only multiple choices and pretty pictures. Let me read that note again." Edith handed it over, while continuing to study the examination paper that had caused all the trouble. "Dear Mr. Craig, I am very sorry to say that I have had to suspend Ada for insubordination. This morning her class was given the attached standard visual perception test. She did extremely well, 95%, with all the problems except number 15. To my surprise, she was the only member of the class to give an incorrect answer to this very simple question. When this was pointed out to her, she flatly denied that she was wrong. Even when I showed her the printed answer, she refused to admit her mistake and stubbornly maintained that everyone else was in error. At this point, it became necessary, for the sake of class discipline, to send her home. I am truly sorry, as she is usually such a good girl. Perhaps you will talk to her and make her see reason. Sincerely, Elizabeth Ives, Headmistress."
"It almost looks," said Donald, "as if she was deliberately trying to fail."
Edith shook her head.
"I don't think so. Even with this mistake, she'd have got a good pass."
Donald stared at the little set of brightly colored geometrical figures that had caused all the trouble. "There's only one thing to do," he said. "You go and talk to her and calm her down. Give me 10 minutes with a scissors and some stiff paper. Then I'll settle it once and for all, so there can't be any further argument."
"I'm afraid that we'll only be tackling the symptoms, not the disease. We want to know why she kept insisting she was right. That's almost pathological. We may have to send her to a psychiatrist."
The thought had already occurred to Donald, but he had instantly rejected it. In later years, he would often remember the irony of this moment. While Edith was consoling Ada, he quickly measured out the necessary triangles with pencil and ruler, cut them from the paper, and joined up the edges until he had made 3 examples of the 2 simplest possible solid figures, 2 tetrahedrons, 1 pyramid, all with equal sides. It seemed a childish exercise, but it was the least he could do for his beloved and troubled daughter.